Welcome to the Veterinary Financial Podcast, where we discuss financial freedom and professional success. I'm Meredith Jones, a veterinarian and financial planner for vets. I posted this question on the Debt-Free Vets Facebook group recently. I said, self-employed relief vets, what financial questions do you have? And you guys had so many great questions, so let's just get right into this. One popular question was related to business entity types. Here are some things to consider when thinking about setting up a business entity for relief work. You don't have to have a separate business entity set up. You can be what the IRS calls a sole proprietor, where you do contract work, but you don't set up a business entity. Some vets do decide to set up an LLC, a limited liability corporation, or a PLLC, which is a professional LLC. Some states have a list of occupations that must set up a PLLC rather than a regular LLC. And sometimes veterinarians are on that list of occupations. So for example, when I set up my LLC in Virginia, I was required to set up a PLLC. It's something that a lot of times you can Google. If you have any questions or you're not sure based on what you can find online, then you can either call the state office that is in charge of helping people set up new business entities. You can also, if you can't tell for sure whether you have to have a PLLC, you can also call the state board and ask them. Either of those are good resources if you can't find the information easily yourself. In a lot of states, it's surprising, you can set up an LLC or PLLC in just about 10 or 15 minutes. It's just a simple application in a lot of states. In other states, it may be a little bit more involved. And so since every state is a bit different, you'll want to research the process. But as we mentioned in our episode about perfectionism, don't research the process to such an extent that you delay things for yourself. Of course, California often has to be a little bit different, right? And so in California, veterinarians cannot practice vet med under an LLC. So if you live in California, you would be looking at just being a sole proprietor or setting up a professional corporation. And you can always consult a qualified professional, so a tax professional, a lawyer, or a financial planner about your specific situation if you have further questions about business entities. So whether you set up an LLC or not, your business income will be what they call a pass-through, meaning that you won't have a separate tax return, and the taxes will just pass through onto your personal tax return. If you do set up a LLC, a couple of things to think about, and a couple of advantages to run through. So once you set up a business entity like an LLC, you'll want to get an EIN, which is an employer identification number, right after that. So that's something that you can do. Strangely enough, it has to be during business hours. You can actually fill out an application. Again, takes about 5-10 minutes to do that. It's on the IRS website, and immediately you'll have that EIN. So an advantage to doing that is that then when you give practices your tax form so that they can pay you, when you give practices your EIN, you can give them that instead of giving them your Social Security number. So if you don't want to have to give your Social Security number out to 15 clinics a year, definitely setting up a business entity and having an EIN can be an advantage there. Other things, so you'll be able to set up a business bank account using that EIN. That helps you keep yourself organized, right? It helps you separate your business transactions from your personal transactions, helps you with bookkeeping, and also make sure that you don't overlook tax deductions if you're using your business account for licensing fees and things like that. We'll talk about tax deductions a little bit later here. This is something else that I have found a lot of people don't talk about that is another advantage depending on your state. So some states require you to publicly list a physical address as a veterinarian. So like under your license, for example, you have to have a physical address. And of course, if you're an employee, then it's easy to just list the physical address of the practice you're working for. In Virginia, for example, a physical address is required and it is public information when someone looks up your veterinary license. And so that's something to keep in mind is that if you have your own LLC, what you can do is, because under the LLC as well, often that physical address is going to be public knowledge. If you want that address to not be your home address, because then clients, you know, crazy clients could look up your home address. If you want that address to be something different, there is something called a registered agent. And registered agent is something where you can pay, it's usually somewhere between $50 and $150 a year. You can use their address instead of listing your home address. And they have a way of scanning mail that you might receive at that address, etc. In Virginia specifically, there is a rule saying, okay, if you have an LLC, then you must be available during business hours in case you ever got served papers for a lawsuit. And so like if you're on vacation, they technically expect people to be available all the time. So that's another reason that the registered agents are out there. So doing this can provide you an additional layer of privacy as a relief vet. So you've got your business entity and then you've got your registered agent. So then you're not having to list your home address as your address on your veterinary license if it is publicly available. Another thing that comes up is questions about S-corps. First thing when I hear S-corp is I think, okay, questions about S-corp, you're probably going to need to consult with a tax professional. But in general, a couple things to consider. So an S-corp is another entity type. It is a consideration if you have a significant portion of your income coming from self-employed relief work. So if you're working 30 hours a week as an employee and or 40 hours a week as an employee, and you're just picking up a couple of relief shifts here and there, you're probably not in a situation where you're going to be setting up an S-corp. But if a significant portion of your income comes from self-employed relief work, it's a consideration. It's not going to be right for everyone. So if you either set up an S-corp, or actually the more common way to do this is having an LLC that is taxed as an S-corp. So 1 year it could be taxed as an S-corp if it makes sense. 1 year it might not be taxed as an S-corp. So this is something to talk with your tax pro about. Generally, as an S-corp, your tax filing costs are going to be higher. And so that's another consideration too, is it's like, okay, people do it to save money on taxes. But then you're also going to need to take into account that the tax filing cost is probably going to be higher as well. It can involve putting yourself on payroll. It can involve hiring a bookkeeper if you don't want to do that yourself and want to outsource it. Definitely something to consult with a tax professional or a financial planner about. Another common question is how to save for retirement. Most of us start out as employees. Most of us start as employees with either a 401k being offered by the employer or simple IRA being offered by the employer. And then if we transition to relief work, and especially if we're not an employee for anyone anywhere at all, right, it's like, okay, well, how do I save for retirement now? It has come up on a couple of other podcast episodes before, but a solo 401k is something that you can either set up yourself or you can work with a financial planner and they can help manage the investments for you and help choose the investments and do the rebalancing of that account and all of those things. A solo 401k allows you to make both employee and employer contributions, meaning that you would still have the same bucket that you could contribute. This year, it's $23,500 that you could contribute on the employee side of a 401k. So it matches what you'd be able to contribute as an employee of someone else, the employee side of that solo 401k. And then in addition to that, you could at tax time, your tax pro could tell you how much you would be able to contribute on the employer side of that account as well. So you have more flexibility where you might actually be able to save more for retirement into your solo 401k than you could as someone's employee. Another one that comes up is a SEP IRA. So that is another type of retirement account for self-employed individuals. One thing about it, though, is it only allows employer contributions. So it wouldn't be one that you would likely contribute to regularly over the course of the year. Or if you did, you wouldn't know, what am I contributing enough? Am I contributing potentially too much? So tax time would be the time that you would know exactly how much you could contribute to that SEP IRA, depending on how much you made in your business that year. So it's not as flexible as the solo 401k, where you would know that you've got that set employee bucket of like $23,500. Contributing to retirement plans, of course, helps you reduce your adjusted gross income, AGI, so helps you reduce your adjusted gross income, and therefore it helps you reduce your taxes. That is, of course, one big reason to contribute to retirement accounts. The other is saving for your future and retiring before you turn 90. So definitely something to take a look at. And like I said, you can set that up on your own and manage it yourself, or you can work with a fee-only financial planner like me. Health insurance is another question that comes up. With health insurance, one thing to keep in mind is that the rules and the availability of plans are widely variable from one state to another. So it's definitely something that you'll want to research. For example, whether or not you can participate in a group plan as a solo business owner varies from one state to another. So in Virginia, you can actually participate in a group health insurance plan as a solo business owner, but in a lot of states, you can't do that. Places that you would want to look. So certainly if you have a partner, joining their health insurance plan may be a good option for you. Other places to look would be to talk with a health insurance broker. So these are folks who, it's their job to research the market and look at different health insurance providers and provide you with some options as far as, okay, what's a good deal out there? And then the marketplace is another place that you can look. And again, that varies. The availability of plans and how good they are varies from one state to another. If you have a high deductible health plan, or if you want to have one, then you would also have the option of contributing to an HSA, a health savings account, and you would have then a bucket of $4,300 as a single person, like the only one on the plan, or if you have family members on that plan with you as well, a bucket of up to $8,550 as a family that you would be able to contribute to that health savings account. So that's another way to reduce adjusted gross income and reduce your taxes. Melanie Goble in the Facebook group, she had a good point about disability insurance. And so she said, have disability insurance, but pay for it personally, not as a business expense, because if you end up using it, then it is taxed as a benefit when paid by the business. And she is exactly right. So you would want to have your own disability policy. So I'm talking about own occupation, long-term disability insurance policy, but you would want to pay for that from your personal bank account rather than the business bank account. And so that was a really good point that Melanie made. Okay, so other questions, and this comes up a lot when I'm talking with clients, quote, picking up shifts as a 1099 and how that plays into taxes if you're also a W-2 employee, slash if it heavily complicates taxes. And then another question was, how important is it to declare quarterly, meaning quarterly taxes, if you don't make that much via 1099? With this one, gosh, there are so many variables, and so I cannot give a blanket answer. And so you may be familiar with Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and Goldilocks is eating the porridge. Okay, so old story, right? Some W-2 employers, so now I'm talking about people who do relief work on the side, but their main job is as a W-2 employee for a clinic. So some W-2 employers take out too little money in taxes, so they withhold too little. Some withhold too much. And for some, the amount of tax that they withhold is just right. So it's just like that Goldilocks story. So you could have one employer not withholding enough in taxes, and you would owe money in taxes without ever doing a single relief shift. But then if you also decide to do relief shifts, you would owe even more in taxes. There's a wide variability where it's like, okay, if I just say, oh, well, if you're only doing a couple of relief shifts a year, you may not need to pay quarterly taxes. That may be true. If we just think about, okay, there's that variability of like, is your regular employer even taking out enough tax to begin with? And then there's the variability of, okay, veterinarians who are working relief shifts, some of them might be charging $900 a shift. Some of them might be getting $2,000 or even $3,000 a shift. So there's a wide range there. And so the devil is in the details, as they say. A couple of things to consider. So if you're working 50 relief shifts in a year, it's probably more important to pay quarterly taxes and get this right than if you're working 2 relief shifts a year. So the main thing that you want to do and to make sure of is that you're not being hit with a big surprise bill during tax season. Generally, there's an expectation that you pay quarterly if taxes are not being taken out of your check. Some people are more conservative and they'd rather pay too much rather than too little. So I know people who do contract work where they're like, oh, I'm going to pay 40% of the money I'm making into taxes just to make sure that I don't have a surprise tax bill. And then there are some people who would rather pay something less, like 30%, and just hold on to some additional savings for taxes in a high yield savings account and know that they might have some degree of a tax bill. And I just threw out that 30 and 40% as just an example. It's not anything like a hard and fast rule, because you'd want to talk with a tax professional about this. Let's see. So a lot of people, I mean, they don't realize it, but paying quarterly taxes, especially the first year that you're doing relief work to any large extent, paying quarterly taxes, it's often a guess and check. There's an exact amount that you're going to owe, sure, but it's unlikely that you're going to know at any given point in the year exactly how much that is. We did have a recent podcast called Perfectionist Traps That Are Costing You Money. And so check out episode 59 if you haven't already. But this is where you don't want to get too bogged down in perfectionism, right? Of like, oh, I don't know the exact amount I should be paying in quarterly taxes, so I'm going to pay nothing. Like, this is not the place to be such a perfectionist that you don't take action. And it's also like, okay, if you pay in an amount, but then you still owe a little bit, that's not a failure. It's good that you paid in the amount that you did so that you didn't have penalties associated with the amount that you did pay in. I can give an example too. I mean, there's even when you have a tax professional who is carefully calculating this, it still may not be exactly correct. An example of that is, so I had a client who had a tax professional. They gave that tax professional a certain set of information. The vet didn't have complete information and the tax professional didn't have complete information. They were making an estimate. So the vet had an estimate of how many relief shifts she was going to work and how much money she would make. So she got an estimate of how much tax she would owe for those relief shifts. And it turns out she made more money than that. And so then she also owed more money in taxes than what was estimated as a result. So if a tax professional and a vet can have a meeting and discuss specific numbers and still not always get it right, then you can see how, you know, me here on a podcast, I'm not a tax pro and I don't have that specific information, I'd have a hard time answering that question. So, you know, it's going to be something where you'll want to, if you're doing a lot of relief shifts, you're going to want to, number one, have a tax professional. Number two, utilize them to help you with these decisions as far as how much should I be paying in for quarterly taxes. So next thing that I'm going to talk through that's a common question is, okay, well, what tax write-offs should I consider? What could I potentially write off to reduce my tax burden as a relief vet? I'll preface by saying that the list of possible deductions that I'm going to go through here are relevant to self-employed relief vets, meaning you are an independent contractor, you are a 1099, and you're not working for somebody else. So if you're employed by somebody else, keep in mind that some of these deductions may not apply to you because, of course, if your employer is paying for it, then it's definitely not a deduction. Okay. Let's talk about things that you could potentially write off, though. State licenses to practice veterinary medicine or prescribe controlled substances are business expenses that can be deducted. Your DEA license as well. Dues for membership to professional organizations such as the AVMA, the State Veterinary Medical Association may be deductible, as well as dues to organizations related to specific species or clinical interests or practice management. And so if you are a member of organizations, professional organizations that have any relation to vet med, those expenses may be deductible. Of course, if you're only working relief part-time and you have an employer that reimburses these expenses, they can't be deducted. Other things, so your professional liability insurance like AVMA, PLIT, or whatever provider you use. Continuing education expenses, so conference registrations, if you take a course, if you take a wet lab, whether it's in person or virtual for your conferences, those expenses are generally things that you could submit to a tax professional and have them consider making deductions related to those things. Business travel, so days that you would be required to travel for a conference, and days that you would be, of course, staying in a hotel out of town at a conference. Often 50% of the meals related to those trips as well. Certainly consult with your tax pro about that. If you use VIN to help answer clinical questions and have a membership with that, or if you use Plums Pro for drug information, those are other expenses that could potentially be deductible. Those are other expenses that could potentially be deductible. If your favorite CE provider has an online subscription, those things could be deductible. So definitely take a look at that as well. Home office deductions. So for home office deductions, the way that works is generally you would need to have a dedicated space in your house where you do things for the business. So like scheduling shifts, sending invoices, doing bookkeeping, doing other work for the business. So it can be a room or it can be part of a room, but it would be a space that would be dedicated to doing work for the business. That can also be a tax deduction. You may be able to write off mileage for traveling to work relief shifts, both, whether it's very far away or it is the next city over. You may need to have a home office to be able to claim mileage. So that's something else to keep in mind. I came across that just this last tax season. Advertising costs. So if you have a website for your relief work, if you have business cards, those are things that may be deductible. Uniforms and equipment, so scrubs, if you have shoes that you have bought specifically for work, if you buy a new stethoscope, some relief vets travel with their own equipment like an ophthalmoscope or an indirect lens that you use for retinal exams, a headlamp, an otoscope, a neurohammer, special cat gloves, feel away spray, any of those things that you might bring along with you that are equipment would also be potential tax deductions. Now, certainly you can be a relief vet and not carry any of those things except for maybe your stethoscope. So not suggesting that you carry all of those things with you. It's just something that I've heard some relief vets say that they've got, a favorite ophthalmoscope that they use or something like that. The qualified business income deduction, so that's something that you would want to consult with your tax pro about as well. So you see a theme here, right? Like consulting with a tax pro. So if you're doing a lot of relief work, if you've been doing your own taxes, you might at this point consider having a pro do your taxes moving forward. And like I said, I'm not a tax professional, so definitely consult with one to determine which deductions are appropriate for you. So being your own boss, it can give you more choices and more freedom, but you'll also need to stay organized financially to avoid headaches, and keeping good records of your expenses throughout the year can give you peace of mind when tax season comes around and hopefully save you money. So if you'd like more help with your taxes, definitely hire a tax professional. If you'd like more help with reaching your financial goals, managing your finances with an irregular income that most relief vets have, saving for retirement, things like that, a financial planner like me can help with those things and a whole lot more. So I'll add my email address to the show notes. Feel free to contact me if you have any questions or if you'd like to chat. And until next time, take care and continue your path to financial success. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered individualized financial advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, it should not be considered a recommendation or endorsement to buy or sell the investment. All investments involve risk. Past performance does not guarantee future results. You are encouraged to seek the advice of a financial professional before implementing any investment strategies discussed. Yay, compliance!